A wonderful morning to all of you, ladies and gentlemen. I know for our Austrian visitors, it might not be the most wonderful of mornings, but a good morning nevertheless. My name is still Damita Pressel. I'm still delighted to be here with you. The focus for today is changing geopolitics. The global landscape is becoming more and more unpredictable and the world order more fragmented. Who shapes war and peace in today's world? That is the big question for our first panel from 9 to 10:30, after which, again, we split up to join our respective workshops. Today, the workshops will be running again in parallel from 11 to 12:30 and from 2 to 4:30. At this point, you should know which workshop you are joining. If not, please contact a member of the team. Lunch will be served in the courtyard today. Luckily, we don't expect rain, so we can eat outside. And at 5, we have another panel on emerging actors in international conflict resolution. We invite you to join us for dinner at the hotel, just like yesterday, from 6:30 to 8. And at 8, we have an evening of music and entertainment prepared for you here in this seminar, in this main conference hall. And we're lucky to have the Young Pannonian Spirit Quartet playing for us again. Those of you who attended the opening of the conference will already know them. They are a quartet of four young people who have founded an orchestra as a peace project and who played a wonderful concert for us on opening night, so you get to enjoy them again tonight. In case anyone in the audience cannot join us this afternoon or won't be here, a few words about tomorrow. Please don't forget to check out of your hotel before coming here tomorrow morning. You can leave your luggage at the hotel in Stadtschleining, but you probably won't have enough time to check out between the end of the conference and the transfer back to Vienna because we only have half an hour. So please, please make sure you check out in the morning, leave your luggage in the hotel so everything goes smoothly. If you are not staying in Stadtschleining, if you're staying in Bad Tatzmannsdorf or Oberwart, if you are booked on the transfer back to Vienna tomorrow at 1, you must bring your luggage here to Stadtschleining tomorrow morning. There will be no transfer back to Bad Tatzmannsdorf or Oberwart after the conference ends, so you won't have the chance to grab it. So avoid having your luggage stuck in a village in Austria. Please bring it here. You don't need to bring it all the way to the conference room. You can leave it. You can also leave it at the hotel Schleining. But please bring it in the morning. It might be easiest even to check out of your hotel tonight, if that's possible for you. As always, if you have any questions or anything is unclear, find a member of the team. You can find the program on our website. There's floor plans just outside the main conference halls. There's also, and this is quite important to us, a feedback form, an online feedback form, that you can find by scanning the QR codes in your program. And the QR codes are also printed in your respective workshop rooms. And we're very grateful for your feedback. We really appreciate you taking the time to fill the forms out, so please do. That's everything you need to know in terms of logistics. Let's move on to the most interesting things, namely the topic of today, changing geopolitics. So as we've discussed in the past few days, we are experiencing an outbreak of armed conflict in many parts of the world, as well as the aftermath of a pandemic and a worsening climate crisis. And all this is making the world more unpredictable, and an international order that many of us took for granted is eroding. What does all that mean? Which new actors are entering the stage? And in this world, who can bring stability and who can ensure peace? Those are the questions we will be discussing on this morning's panel. And I'm very happy to welcome on stage your moderator. She's a member of the advisory board at the Austrian Center for Peace, Angela Kane.
Thank you very much, Damita. Thank you very much, and it's good to be here. And thank you for coming in such numerous numbers, because I know it's early in the morning, and as you heard, we have a very long day. But we have a very, very interesting panel with excellent participants and panelists, and I would like to ask them to please come to the panel table. And the first one is Mustafa Aydin. Please come here. Sit to my left. Mustafa Aydin is a... Let me introduce them one by one. Thank you, Mustafa. And he is the president of the International Relations Council of Turkey. And he's a professor at Kadir Has University, Ankara University's background with Harvard, international politics and security. And the second panelist is Happy Moon Jacob. Please come, Happy Moon. He is an associate professor. No, you sit in the middle. We're doing this alphabetically. We're doing very, you know, focused. He is the associate professor at the School of International Studies of Jawaharlal Nehru University, and he specializes in security and international affairs with a focus specifically on arms control and disarmament. And our last speaker is Luo Jiangqi. She is the program manager. Welcome, Jiangqi, for External Affairs at Jiangshan Forum, and she's a researcher at the Academy of Military Sciences at the PLA. And again, she has focuses on international security and has a focus on the U.S. military. And I'm very delighted to welcome you all here. We have an hour and a half, just about, before we break for coffee. And I think that we've seen already in the last 2 days how interesting the program is, and we are again adding to this because what we're calling this, it's emerging powers in a fragmented world, and I think it links up very well to what we've done in the last 2 days, particularly also because we had a focus on, let's say, Ukraine last night, etc. So that was very interesting, but now we are having three experts on international security, not necessarily regional security, and I look forward to the debate. And what I just wanted to say by way of introduction is that the stability that we had reached in Europe after the breakup of the Soviet Union obviously has disappeared. It's no longer there. The European has not evolved into the political powerhouse we had hoped it would become. And the emergence of states like India, China, Brazil, and others has really shaken the post-World War order. The hegemon that the United States, the position, took for a long time is really being challenged. And what does it mean? What we have seen in the last couple of years in particular, and we've talked already quite a bit about this, is that we have been seeing increases in war, we've been seeing increases in conflict around the world. And yesterday, I remember this figure of 185 conflicts was mentioned. And they're not only just conflicts, but they're actually major conflagrations, like the Russian invasion into Ukraine in February 22, or the Hamas-Israel war that has now been raging for 9 months. And there are plenty of other hotspots around the world that are very, very difficult and that are very, very painful right now to witness. So we have a number of questions, and I want to start off with the first one to ask the panelists to give their view of how the world has evolved and what can possibly be done also. And that is, why does an increasing number of states resort to war for reaching their objectives? Let me start with you, Aydin, please.
Thank you, Angela. I think if I try to understand what's happening in the world and what's happening in the global system, I might be able to circle back to the question why more countries are now resorting to the war. So if we look at the world order, so-called world order, and the people, how they are describing this current changes, differences, the words we see is fragmented, uncertain, changing. So these are the words that doesn't give you confidence in life. It creates anxiety, it creates uncertainty for the future, and it makes you feel insecure in your own life. And the states are similar to the people anyway. So they still feel uncertain, and insecure for their grounding. Looking to the international system, traditionally international relations discipline has been looking to the systems from a power polar perspective. We have classified international system, especially in the 20th century, from the perspective of polarity. So we had a bipolar world. At the end of the Cold War, we had a unipolar world, and people are talking we had maybe having multipolar world. However, I would argue that we have to go beyond this polar structural analysis to look at the new emerging international system. Because the power relationships that this polar analysis is based is no longer valid. Although you might see the manifestations of power in international relations today, we are facing so many other problems and issues that are not we will not be able to deal with as power, with power structures and power relationships. So we We have continuous financial problems. We have a continuous ecological problem, worsening of ecology globally. We had pandemic, so worsening the health situation globally. We have new challenges coming from technological advances and artificial intelligence. So all these are, none of these are explainable or can be dealt with power relationship or the polar structures. So we need to have some sort of a new type of an analysis or perspective to describe what kind of a world order we are moving into. So looking into this kind of order, some people define it apolarity, you know, moving about, around and moving away from the polar analysis. They call it that we are going through towards an apolar world. And some people call multi-ordered world, emphasizing different types of orders, different types of rules to be accepted in different parts of the world. And some people, mostly coming from the left, argue that we are moving to what they call pluripolarity. So this is different than multipolar world. It doesn't based on differences on power, but it's based on attitudes, acceptances of different sets of worldviews, totally different sets of rules, engagements, and etc. So we are, these people argue that what's emerging is different worlds, essentially. In the Earth, we have one Earth, but different worlds living totally differently from each other. But it's what is very clear for me is that we are moving into with various axes and moving away from the center of action, which was for last 150 years, Europe and the world orders that have been defined in last 200 years were actually focusing in Europe, whether we were doing things in Europe or whether they were organized on the borders of Europe, but nevertheless it was focusing on Europe. 20th century is the century that we started to moving beyond Europe, and I think 21st century is that the century that Europe no longer is not only in the center, but even in the periphery. It's somewhere there among other one of the other regions. So looking into this kind of multi-ordered dynamics, a relationship between these different worlds seems to be developing hierarchical, but the relationship between these worlds with each other seems to be developing anarchical. Going back to the traditional realist perspective of the international relations, the international relations seems to be continue to be anarchical, but not only between states, now between different worlds, existing of different worlds. When I look at international politics, what's happening recently, first of all, I'm seeing the extended period of geopolitical disparity has ended, bringing back the what I would call geopolitics. You know, this is not a discipline of geopolitics, bringing back like 19th century type of brutal geopolitics with great power competition, with imperial ambitions for some countries, although they don't call it imperial, but it nevertheless looks very much imperial ambitions, and with fight over resources, which might be intensifying in near future. Second, we are seeing an end of consolidation and spread of democracy, which gives way to authoritarianism, back to authoritarianism, I should say. Because democracy, when we start writing about democracy, we start from ancient Greece, which has nothing to do what we came to associate in the 20th century as democracy. Democracy, as we understand, especially in the second part of the 20th century and spread in the early 21st century, is totally different. And it's a very new idea, actually. You know, it has at most 100 years of history. Authoritarianism, imperial building, has thousands of years of history. So we are now moving, it seems that we are now eclipsing this democracy period and moving back to this authoritarian system or understanding of governing. Whether this is good or bad, we have to talk about it, or whether we can fight it back with it, we'll have to talk about it. There is also, I see, an end of period of consensus building and cooperation in international relations. For the future of the global order, we are not able to discuss the common problems, global problems, that needs to be global responses. That's very clear now. Every country, more or less, are now trying to respond to issues or challenges as they see nationally. The global responses, even the pandemic response, we miserably failed to respond it globally and cooperated. So this opens way to fractured and disputed international system. And last two is we are seeing the end of period of globalization, and of course with it, end of economic interdependence. Now, allowing to trade protectionism, economic sanctions, intense competition to rise. It's not a by chance that many countries are employing trade sanctions as a punishment today, much more widespread than any time in last 150 years. You know, trade sanctions were very familiar way of doing business in the 19th century, but not in the 20th century and early 21st century, but it's coming back also. And finally, we have seen, depends on where you are looking, the end of US leadership, if you like, the US hegemony, leading to crisis, domestic crisis in the United States, which encourages international crisis as well. It becomes an international crisis because some people or some segments of the society within the United States do not like what they are seeing internationally. So they want to change it, to change the system that the United States helped build or created. This leads more crises in international system. So-called rule-based international order, or if you like, liberal world order, or if you like, Western lead world order, is challenged not only by the states from outside this system, mostly and more importantly from the states within the system and from the states who actually created the system. At two levels, I think. One is in applying double standards for the rules in the rules-based international order. By definition, rules-based international order requires the rules to apply equally to every state. But increasingly what we are seeing is double standards in applying the rules to different states in different parts of the world. This undermines the credibility and value of the international system. And the second level is, again, relates to the United States. The upholder of the system is no longer happy with the outcome of the system, because the system has produced a challenger or challengers to the position of the United States. So the US is not happy anymore, and it doesn't want to uphold this system, which might eventually replace the United States. So it doesn't anymore invest in the system and or protecting the system. This, of course, and at best, it tries to reform the system according to its liking, which nobody else likes, actually. The system that some people in the United States thinks for the world to evolve involves continuation of the leadership of the United States. Not even the hegemony, I should remind you, leadership, which is different than the hegemony. Actually, if you look at the definition of hegemony, that involves consent. Part of the American society today is not interested in the international consent. What is it interested in? Leadership of the United States, whether people consent to it or not. So it's forceful. All these have weakened the international system, resulting lack of the direction and leadership, which creates further uncertainties and encourages and allows the states in different parts of the world to resort military power to achieve what they want to achieve. because it allows many countries, especially if you look at sub-regions of the world, not globally, but sub-regions of the world, there you see power vacuums have emerged, vacuums of rules have emerged. So when countries see that the supposed upholder of the system does not respect the rules when it suits its interest, and when they see the possibility of behaving beyond the rules of international system because power gap or vacuums, they do so. So that's the long answer to your short question.
Thank you very much to giving us this overview of the international situation. I think it's a very sobering analysis, and I think it's all waking us up early in the morning to sort of see what's coming down the pike, because what we're facing is really stressors in the international system, a breakdown partially of the rules-based order, the challenges that are appearing from all parts of the globe, and what I think you talk about, the multipolarity or epolarity or plurapolarity, if I've gotten all of this, these are kind of new expressions that I think we'll have to get used to a lot more. I thank you for outlining it in such an excellent stage. Now, we come to the next next panelist, and that's Happy Moon. And he gets the exact same question, but now I would like to ask you from a South Asian perspective. How does it look? Why does an increasing number of states resort to war for reaching their objectives? What do you tell us?
Thank you, Ambassador Carney. I think that's an important question that needs some reflection. You know, since this is about emerging actors in international politics, I'm going to sort of begin by a few remarks on where India stands vis-a-vis the international order today. I think that will clarify a lot of things that I'm going to say here on. I would say there are three quick features of how India views the international order. The first one, if you were to look at India during the Cold War years, this was a sort of a revisionist power. What is non-alignment, for example? It basically means, I don't like this, I won't do this, you can't make me do this. That's basically what non-alignment is about. Today, India does not talk about non-alignment. India believes that the international order is unequal, discriminatory, and unrepresentative. It still believes that. During the Cold War years, it had a revisionist approach to how to change the international system. Today, it says, make us a stakeholder in the international system. So the view remains, but the approach has changed. That's my first point. Secondly, I think the reason why this view, the approach has changed is because of the function of the growth in power. Today, India is a nuclear weapon state. It's close to $4 trillion GDP. The most populous country on planet Earth. Not that it counts beyond a point. But in many ways, its power has grown. I think the ability of the country to assert power has also created a feeling within the country that we need to be a stakeholder in the international system. The third point that I want to make about India's view of the international order is that many of the proposed solutions that India would put forward in the international system are a function of its view of itself in the international system. It's no longer an outsider. It wants to sort of put its foot down and say, hey, we are an insider. We want to play. We want to be a stakeholder. We are part of the system. So I think these three things are quite important. So to summarize, India desires a multipolar world in which India is a pole and a stakeholder. Not that India loves a multipolar world for the sound of it, but because India believes that its chances of becoming a pole are higher in a multipolar world, number one. Number two, in the absence of India's accommodation into some of the global governance platforms, you will see Indians continuing to be promoting mini-laterals and other such global platforms, be it the Global South, the BRICS, or the SCO, or name it, you have it. So if we are not made part of those platforms, such as the UNAC, we are going to be promoting some other platforms. I think that's the answer that India has towards its exclusion from global platforms. India will, I think, continue to play a role in the system and seek changes in the system. But as the Chinese colleague pointed out yesterday, I think this demand for change in the system is going to be an orderly one, in the sense that we don't want a revolutionary change in the system. We want a slow change. and responsible change to the international order. Now let me, Ambassador Khan, I come to the question that you asked about why does an increasing number of states resort to war for reaching their objectives? I think to begin with, you're looking at the failure of multilateralism in many ways. The Indians haven't really taken in by the promise of the beauty of multilateralism, as it were. The Indians have always believed that it is really, the global order is not global enough. It is not really order in that sense. So I think multilateralism has failed. Might is right. And the breakdown of the international order in some ways, or multilateral system in some ways, is symptomatic of the fact that it's simply not working. Now, when you don't, when you have a system that is not working, which means it provides systemic permissibility for more violence and more kinetic action by states to meet their demands. So I think there is, because of the decay in global institutions and failure of the international order, you have more permissibility in the system to sort of take recourse to wars and conflicts to meet their objectives, point number one. And secondly, you have more new powers on the scene today. China is one. I would say India in a smaller scale. India is another country. So you have multiple actors on the global scene that are emerging. And when they see that their objectives and demands cannot be fulfilled by the existing system, I think they will take matters into their hands. That's in some ways what is also happening. So if you can't meet my objectives, if you can't reflect the reality of the contemporary geopolitical structure, as it were, then these countries are going to in some ways also take matters into their hands. I think the other issue that I want to sort of point out in answer to that question is that wars have always been taking place in various parts of the world, be it in Africa, be it in Asia, or be it in other parts of the world. But I think the question that comes from the Western world, why is the world more violent today? Why is the world more conflict-ridden today? Also tells you that the West has probably not been really paying attention to the wars and the conflicts and the bloodshed that has been taking place in other parts of the world. As you know, our foreign minister, Jaishankar, said not too long ago, Europe thinks that its problems are the world's problems and the world's problems are not its problems. So I think my retake on that is that conflict has always been there. Wars have taken place. Wars have been taking place. You probably have not been noticing. I mean, statistically speaking, I agree with you. There is more violence today. There's more death today. But it has always been taking place. Europe is restive. Your borders are becoming more violent. And therefore, you're worried about it. But for us, coming from the parts of the world that we come from, Afghanistan, Myanmar, India, Pakistan. We have our issues, India and China. China has its own issues. Or in Africa, there are wars happening. I think these have always been there. The final point that I want to make in response to that interesting question is that I think the focus should not just be on wars and violence in the traditional sense of the term. I think we should also focus on the structural conditionalities that lead to violence, the structural exclusion of actors in the international community. You're talking about climate change injustice, for example. We have a commitment of $100 billion as climate change finance to poorer countries. That has never been met. Now, is that indicative of a certain kind of structured violence in the international system, if you ask me? Yes. You ask countries like India to change their climate change policies, you need to, energy transition. For a lot of people in India, for hundreds of millions of people in India and other countries, I'm sure, first transition is access to energy. So for us, a lot, for hundreds of millions of these people, energy transition can wait until we first get energy. So I think our understanding of what is conflict and what is violence needs to be expanded. It can't be seen only in the traditional realist sense of A country attacks country B and X number of people die. I agree, that is not non-serious, that is of course serious. But there's life beyond that. Back to you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much, Happy Moon. And you bring in a different perspective, and that's basically also the discriminatory aspect of the global order and how you see that from the Indian side or how you see it from South Asia side. And I appreciate that you did this. And you call it the failure of multilateralism. I will go on to this a little bit later because I find this a very interesting part to look at, not only all the failures and all of the difficulties that we're experiencing, but also what can we possibly do, what can we possibly think about if we want to address this failure and we want to bring the world back to a place that is a little bit more equal and that is a little bit more less violent and that is a little bit more peaceful and where people have the right to live their lives in freedom and also in peace. I think that is very important. And you sort of said the global order wasn't global anymore, which I also think was an interesting statement to make, but we'll come back to that. Now we'll have a perspective from a little bit further to the east, from China. So, Yangzhi, please, I'm asking you the same question again. I won't repeat it, but you know what it is. Yeah.
Thank you, Angela. I just noticed I am the furthest from the east, according to the seats. Wow. Since my colleagues have been already shared their views on the geopolitical, the overall power structure of the current world, I would like to add a little bit more like theoretical aspect to our discussion here by introducing a concept of relative power. I think when we talk about the power distribution, it's not just the current status of how power has been distributed among different countries, it's also the power dynamic between countries. So there is an assumption that if the power dynamics has been moving against a country's will, and then it will resort to war to achieve its objectives. So, like, if there are two powers, and this is its major perceived threat, and the power dynamics is becoming like against its will, it's in the disadvantaged way. Then the power initiate war if they are more unconfident with their perspective. Comprehensive power accumulation with the power dynamics with major threat they perceived. So it's with the days going, the power distribution is against us. So it's better today than tomorrow. Then it's more likely to resort to war. That is the theory. So then we back to the question, why there are more and more countries resort to war? I think, according to my colleagues has been talked about, it's like maybe it's because the power structure or all the power distribution in the world is becoming flat. The structure is moving from the hierarchical system to the more flat system. So the power distribution among countries, the absolute advantage is losing. So the hierarchical system is becoming replaced by the multipolar system. That's why more and more people think, well, it's better today than tomorrow. So since I still got the advantage and my advantage is losing, so why not? Let's resort to war to solve my problem. So then we're back to the classic international relations theory question. Which is better, the unipolar system, the bipolar system, or the multipolar system? So I think the answer to this question depends on which perspectives we take. So if I am the state on the top of the pyramid, then of course the hierarchical system, the unipolar system is the best. So we can recall that when the scholar said this is the end of the history. So I think, yeah, I'm on the top of the mountain, I'm on the top of the world, that's the best. But if we, from the other perspective, when the system moving from the hierarchical system to the more flat, to the multipolar system, then my voice have finally been heard. So the system can finally think about more of my interest. Then from this perspective, I think maybe the multipolar world is a better world for the majority of us. Yeah, I think that's my short answer to Angela's first question.
Okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Yangqi. That was very good. And also appreciate your viewpoint in terms of the multipolarity.
Thank you.
And the unipolarity. And when we talk about the wars that are currently occurring, and I'm particularly talking about the ones that we've seen recently, the Russia-Ukraine and also Israel-Hamas war, I'm leaving out many other wars. I don't mean to be dismissive of any other conflicts that are raging in other parts of the world. But I'm reminded also of the proxy wars that took place during the so-called Cold War, when you had the USSR and the United States fighting in other countries, but rather, you know, whether it's Angola, whether it's, you know, other areas. But what to me it is very clear now is what it seems to be the aim is to have an absolute victory in a war. There is no way that you can negotiate. There's no way that you can have a settlement, and that seems to be just not the order of the day, and that I find extremely regrettable, because the question is, do people, do countries go for absolute victory? Do they really want to have a victory? We have other situations in the world where you have like a frozen conflict, where a frozen conflict basically was never solved, but remained frozen in time. That does not seem to be the possibility anymore. So if you're looking at absolute victory, do you think that this is the objective? And if it is, what does that mean for the rest of the world? Now, let me start in a different order. I'll start with you, Habimon, and then we'll go around this way, okay?
Thank you. I'm not convinced that this is the age of absolute victory. I think we are still talking about limited objectives of all the conflicts / wars. I mean, I was telling my colleagues yesterday that China calls the Russia-Ukraine war a crisis, and India calls it a situation, and or some other word. We don't call it wars, be that as it may. So I don't think these conflicts / situations / wars are pursued for absolute victory. I think depending on how we define absolute victory, but I think the objectives are in many ways limited. But what it has done is that it has somehow created global ripples and implications. So these wars are not contained in their locations, as it were. The implications of these wars are not contained in their respective locations. For example, you're talking about the Russia-Ukraine war having an implication for the rest of the world in the sense that there is the weaponization of the trade. You're talking about the weaponization of globalization, the sanctions, which are not really sanctioned by the United Nations Security Council, etc., etc. And countries like India have been at the receiving end of the weaponization of trade, at the receiving end of the weaponization of globalization, etc. So when we look at it, our outlook is biased by a certain past experience that we have had. We are also talking about a certain amount of attempt to create blocks in the international system, mm-hmm. and the Chinese will come in on the undesirability of block competition in the international system. And there is, especially when it comes to the Russia-Ukraine war, there is the issue of democracies versus non-democracies. So we had, high-profile visitors in Delhi who came and told Indians that if you don't support democracies, if you don't fall in line, you will face consequences. So Indian side, given the nature of the government that we have in India today, they said, take a walk. That India of 1960s and 70s is gone. Today, you're looking at a different international system. So while I don't think that we are looking at absolute victory, it has global implications, or attempts have been made to make these conflicts look more like international conflicts. I think what has returned, if not the age of absolute victory, I don't think has returned, but what has returned is the principle that might is right. I mean, be it Russia, be it Israel, the argument that might is right. If I have the power, I will do what it takes to win the war, or what it takes to meet my objectives. So the might is right argument has returned. What has returned is the unencumbered pursuit of one's interests. There are no international institutions or structures to stop an actor from pursuing his or her interests or its interests if it has the power to do so. Again, Russia is a case in point. Israel, if you ask me, is a case in point. So I think I don't necessarily agree with, unless until I'm given a definition of what we mean by absolute victory and how this is applicable in these cases, I don't think that has returned. What, as I said, has returned is something else, which is one is the globalization, the forced globalization of some of these conflicts. And the other is, because of the structural decay, you're talking about a certain amount of might is right and the unencumbered pursuit of those interests. Back to you.
Thank you very much. I think that's the position also that was mentioned by Aydin in terms of might is right, but also it's the return of brutal power, basically, but it's gain of resources, etc., etc. I want to come back to you, Yangqi, and you had mentioned about the hierarchy, and of course, mm-hmm. depending on where you look. Mm-hmm. So my question is, of course, China has risen tremendously in stature, in power, and clearly is now at eye level with the United States. So how does it look from the Chinese side? And what I also want to mention is, because you've seen a tremendous realignment of power also among the P5, if I can call that, which of course came out of the Second World War in terms of the United Nations positions. But you've had a tremendous realignment between Russia, the Russian Federation, and China. So how is that changing the look that one has from the Chinese side?
Okay. Thank you, Angela. Well, actually, before reaching to your question, I would like to talk. Happy Moon just mentioned, when we talk about the absolute victory, actually, somebody did her homework. I did look into what is the definition of the absolute victory. Well, it's apparently, it have this like different aspect. It's like total military defeat and unconditional surrender, complete occupation, political control, and long-term stability. If we look into this definition of the absolute victory, then I don't think we are in the age, or we are back to the age of absolute victory. Because in the current ongoing conflict around the world, and of course, even the Russian-Ukraine, they have both sides of the political leaders have expressed that they're prepared to talk, at least. So they are, maybe the environment is not yet, but they are prepared, they are still open to talks. So I don't think it's way back to the age of absolute victory. And when we go back to Angela's question and how like the China views the international norms and international orders. And I think we've touched this yesterday. Like, we admit China has been benefit from the current international systems. We admit that the economic development and the comprehensive national power is growing. That's the fact. And we don't think like China has been accused of being a revolutionist of the international system. And people are saying like we would like to overthrow all of the international systems to build a new one. I think that's untrue. That's not true. And we only think, I think China as well as India and Turkey and other emerging powers, we just think the current international system, it's good, but it needs some adjustment. It needs some adjustments to according to the change of the time with the development in technologies and the development in the power distribution as we talked before. So maybe there could be some improvement and not a totally overthrow of it. Yeah, that's my question. Oh, that's my answer. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm coming to you, Aydin, and I was struck by the fact that you also mentioned the sanctions and the recurrence of sanctions, which is now the primary means of states really to express how shall I say, measures, curtailment, displeasure. But I find it very interesting because when you look at sanctions, the sanctions are biting very hard, not only on the trade, but also because of the US financial system, because the dollar monopolizes international trade as 80% of all trade is conducted in the US dollar. So if you exclude countries by way of sanctions from participating in that system, I mean, what do you see as the possibility to relax that or to change that? And I think it also goes back to, you know, positions that have been taken by China and I believe also by India.
Before that, let me talk about a little bit, a few minutes, about this absolute victory fallacy.
Yes.
It's a fallacy because there is no absolute victory. You know, if you look at in the history, every leader who started the war aims for absolute victory. Mm-hmm. Right? There is no way that you would start a war thinking that, okay, let's try to get this, achieve this in our national interest, but at the end we will negotiate to have less. Nobody says that. So there is this comparison between reality versus rhetoric. Mm-hmm. In rhetoric, everybody aims for absolute victory. In reality, it's very rarely achieved. And when it's achieved, when, if you look at the history, it's only achieved, so far I can ascertain, after the world wars. You know, the global wars, everybody joins in and put the effort together and you just absolutely destroy your enemy and you achieve absolute victory. But otherwise, from state to state, one state to another, I don't see much of a examples, maybe in ancient times, but not in modern times. So the order of the world today is mostly protracted conflicts, continuation of the conflicts. Some people call them frozen conflicts. Obviously, we know that they are not frozen, but they bubble behind the scenes. They continue to kill people. They continue. All this, of course, this continuation of frozen conflicts leads to weaponization of everything, mm-hmm. including the trade, but also weaponization of ideology, weaponization of political system. Everything becomes a weapon in this kind of a hybrid continual warfare. I think what we have entered today is not the return of classical war, which has always been with us. What we have entered today is a new type of a warfare that is hybrid, which weaponizes everything, which is more permissive, more intrusive to our lives, and it decays the societies without our realization of it. Mm-hmm. Right? It decays the societies who are employing these tools of warfare and decays them. I don't buy this. I never bought this idea of democracies versus non-democracies. It's one of the bylines and storylines of history. You divide, in my own country, politics has been done in the last 20, 25 years by dividing the society. You divide the society, whatever means it's necessary, and you take a bigger segment and move on to the next debate. So a debate between, the fight between democracies and non-democracies is just one like that. You divide the international society, you try to grab the bigger part of the international society and move on to the next debate. I think it's not healthy. In the long term, it will be destructive for the international system. The sanctions, when you sanction somebody, a country or a people, they try to find a way around it. You cannot submit the sanctions. In international relations literature, there is a huge literature arguing, debating, and proving that sanctions ultimately do not work. They create their ecosystems whereby the countries sanctioned find new alternatives and new connections. The United States has sanctioned Cuba forever. I mean, you know, it's longer than my life. The United States has sanctioned Iran since 1979. Did Iran submit? No. Did Cuba submit? No. Would Russia submit to sanctions? I don't think so. Would it weaken the ability to fight those countries? Might. It depends on the structures of the international system. If you are able to induce all the power centers in international system to cooperate with your sanctions, you know, if the sanction is global, then it works. Like the sanctions against the apartheid regime in Africa. It finally worked because it became global in that sense. But you know, sanctions today, especially the United States, used by United States, is used, I think, because of not their effectiveness. It's because this is what is available to United States. Because the American people today does not want to see or do not want to see American forces abroad fighting the wars. They are fed up with it because of Afghanistan and Iraq and all the others. So what is available if you are a leader in the United States? What is available to you? You have only one tool, the sanctions. That's why the United States is using increasingly the sanctions, maybe more often than it's any time in its history. But it also shows that it's weakness. And I think it will eventually lead to what you might call innovative ways of sanction evading. I'll finish with a personal note. There is a person called Mustafa Aydin. He is on the US sanctions list. He is a person associated with a company who's evading US sanctions in Syria. Mm-hmm. It's obviously not me, but I have not been able to receive or send money internationally because the American imposed SWIFT system for last 5-6 years prevents this. Because it's Mustafa Aydin, which is very, you know, very usual name in Turkey, sanction violates. When I talk to the American Treasury, they say there is nothing, which is their right. There is nothing in their, you know, wording. This person is not me. They know it. But it doesn't help me. So what I do, I mean, you know, I receive money regularly from abroad, and I send money regularly to abroad, especially when I drive in different countries and get traffic fines. I find ways. You know, innovative ways. I'm not going to tell you what are those innovative ways, but the countries does the same thing, so it doesn't work. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing this personal mishap, if I can call it that. But I also want to say with you, because you're absolutely right, because sanctions can be evaded and are being evaded. But I wanted to mention that South Africa actually was able to build a nuclear bomb despite the sanctions. There was a big book published on it, and I spoke to the author at one point, and it was fascinating how they went around the sanctions. Now, I think it is an unusual case, but on the other hand, I think it's one of the most powerful cases that can make for the fact that sanctions really are more of a punitive measure that really is not very well effective when it comes. We have about half an hour, and I have lots of questions and a lot of comments, but I don't want to forestall the audience from asking also questions. So I'm going to have to kind of have a 360 vision here or 180 vision, so in case there are any questions that come up. Yes, I see two gentlemen in the back. Three over here. So please, let's have the microphone. Yes, Martin, we'll come in the next round, or maybe we'll add one more. Let's see. Can we have the microphone, please?
Otherwise, perhaps.
No, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. I think they weren't quite prepared. Maybe I should have given a signal a little earlier. Okay. I know you have a powerful voice, but it'll be even better with a microphone.
Thank you very much indeed. Otherwise, I had tried to use my infantry voice. My name is Kweku Danso, and I work as a researcher with the Kofi Annan International Peacekeeping Training Center. Thank you very much indeed for those very excellent submissions. But I think there's a sense in which what we are witnessing on the collective plane in the international system in terms of the change is also a contestation between revisionism and status quo maintenance, all of which are in turn underpinned by the dominance of whiteness, which has been intrinsic to the manner in which security, or if you like, international security has been conceptualized. The narrow methodological whiteness that has, for centuries or decades at least, defined security, so that what we see projected as global security is often nothing global or international at all, but white security. And we see that manifest even in institutions of global governance, such as the UN Security Council, the International Criminal Court, and so on and so forth. To the extent that, you know, even the discussions here is focused on a certain type of conflict. And you were right when you mentioned that conflict have always been going on. In Africa, conflicts have been going on. But all those conflicts are sort of pushed to the margins because they do not really matter. But the question I seek to ask is, what do all this change mean for human emancipation? Emancipation from the markets, emancipation from technology. What do they mean? Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And let me go to the person in the same row, or in the row before, please.
Thank you very much, and congratulations for these insightful presentations on such an interesting topic. I have two simple questions. One is on semantics, and words are important, I think, today. I remember that Bismarck, the German Empire, used to say, in order to avoid war, let's define words. And I heard the definition of the conflict, Hamas-Israel. My master's thesis was on Arab-Israeli conflict back in 1917. And clearly the number of deaths, there are more Palestinian dead than Hamas fighters. I think it's Israeli-Palestine conflict, to name it, in order to go through the root causes and go to a solution, I think. The second question is on war. I believe that today it's not only weapons, but also information. In our end, West Africa, I think for us today, the arm of massive mental destruction is disinformation. And I think it's a new way of defining war, I think. Beyond military, there is also that one. It is very critical. And I read some high-level military strategists calling it cognitive war. I think that would be interesting to have your insights on that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing in yet another dimension of this in terms of the disinformation and what can be done actually to stoke war as well. So we've got someone else. Yes?
Yes, hello. Thanks a lot for your presentation. And I want to come back to the total victory fallacy that was mentioned several times. And as also Mustafa said, of course, you start a war because you think you win it. And with Ukraine, let's remember, this was not a limited operation. We had a huge, massive buildup of troops in Belarus or from the eastern side, so it was a massive operation. But it was not enough, obviously. And Ukraine managed to stop Russian troops, and we are now where we are. I also would like to reflect on unintended consequences. We remember Donald Rumsfeld speaking about the known unknowns and the unknown unknowns. And also, I can imagine that a guy in the Kremlin also thinks about these unknown unknowns, and suddenly he has NATO on the border to St. Petersburg. Suddenly he has a realignment shift, and it's the same for Beijing, for what's happening in Shanghai. I also wonder if really Beijing is happy with the fact that suddenly Europe, at least, and also the United States, Canada, and a lot of other countries see it basically, okay, this could be the new bloc of North Korea, China, and Russia. I would not want to be in that position, to be very honest. I wonder if people in Beijing are. So the sooner the first shots are fired, things change. A huge new dynamic comes into place, which could lead to even more catastrophe that we're in. And this is also, I want to ask you, what about the risk? You know, you start a war and you don't know where it will end up. And it starts with, we don't know today, where did World War II start? Was it in Asia? Was it the Japanese? Was it maybe the Spanish Civil War? You never know where the actual war started. And the same, I think, the same situation we could be in now. So I'm wondering what your thoughts about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We're going to have to stop here because there are a lot of questions that were raised, and I want to give the panelists the possibility to answer. And I wonder, there was also the dominance of weapons that was mentioned, and maybe I can leave that to, you know, did I hear this incorrectly? The first speaker was talking about the conflicts in Africa.
Yes, so I was talking about the dominance of whiteness in the manner in which we have
talked. Oh, I thought I unheard. Okay, fine, my mistake, I heard weapons, yeah. Anyway, there were a number of issues that were mentioned, and also talked about conflicts pushed to the margins, which I think we all recognize is a fact. And the disinformation was mentioned, and also the total victory issue. So maybe I can ask one of you, Habibun, are you willing to volunteer on this? Yeah.
Let me take the first set of questions, which is about the issue of emancipation and that of misinformation? Disinformation, you said. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely right. Okay. With all that is happening around us, how do we achieve human emancipation? I think it's a fundamental question. At the end of the day, it's not the nation states that live; it's also the individuals, human beings that live. I know where that argument is coming from, and I completely empathize with that argument. I think to get to that level, we must begin with a great deal of humility. Nation states must begin with a great deal of humility. And sometimes countries will have to address and shed the deep-seated colonial practices which continue to exist in their practices, in their mindset, in their thinking. Although the gentleman apologized, I'm going to quote the words of the European Union's High Representative for Foreign Affairs and Security Policy, Joseph Borrell. He said, "Europe is a garden. We have built a garden. The rest of the world is not exactly a garden. Most of the rest of the world is a jungle. The jungle could invade the garden. The gardeners should take care of it. The jungle has a strong growth capacity. Walls will never be high enough in order to protect the garden. The gardeners have to go to the jungle. Europeans have to be much more engaged with the rest of the world, otherwise the rest of the world will invade us by different ways and means." These words speak for themselves, ladies and gentlemen. The jungle did not invade Europe, it was the other way around. And the history is short-lived in this part of the world. I think it is important to recognize that. It is important to have that humility. And emancipation and world orders cannot be built on the basis of political arrogance and short-lived memories. You know, this garden mindset has a lot of implications. One of the implications is what I mentioned earlier, the Eurocentric mindset, which my foreign minister spoke about. I'm not particularly a fan of my government in Delhi. Be that as it may, I mean, I have political differences with that, but I think he made a very interesting point. Europe has to grow out of the mindset. I mean, we also have our own issues. We have to grow out of our mindset. India has to stop behaving like a bully in its neighborhood in South Asia. I completely agree with that. China has its problems. But it is a problem that is localized in many ways. These are problems that do not have global implications, as it were. The second issue is that of hypocrisy. We talk about, and I'm sorry, I'm being critical here. You invited me, I should be a good guest. But it is important that we look at these things with a certain sense of realism and genuine change for desire. The International Criminal Court, is that not a part of the rules-based international order? People are talking about sanctioning that just because a certain potential judgment is going to be not in the preference of certain countries. I'm sorry, you can't build an international order like that. You can't have emancipation It has to start with, you know, the mindset of certain countries and certain individuals. But on the question, I completely agree with the second point about Israel-Palestine. It is a war. It's Israel-Palestine. It is not Hamas-Israel war. Yes, Hamas started it. That's a bunch of criminals. That's a bunch of terrorists. I have no issues in calling them what they are. At least that's my sense. But it has become something far more than that. Let's call it by what it is. Disinformation. I think I have a more, somewhat of a technical approach to the question of disinformation. And that is, yes, we are seeing a rise in disinformation, but we are also seeing alternatives to counter the spread of disinformation. If there is a certain disinformation happening, there is also an alternative that is available, which was not the case in the 1970s and 60s and 50s, right? If you were taught, if you were told, if you were schooled, brainwashed in a particular way, you remain that way. Today there are avenues that you can explore to change that mind. I leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your frankness also. I think that's very welcome. I wanted to ask if any of the two of you... Yeah, Yangqi, mm-hmm. Please go ahead. Yeah.
I would like to add a little bit to the question of the misinformation. I think with the development of the internet and social media, in nowadays conflict, we see more and more like disinformation, misinformation. It become a means of a conflict. It's how people against each other. I think that's only a part of the whole revolution of the warfare, or we say change of the warfare. Because like when we look back into the time when we first invent the gunpowder, how people fight like totally changed, right? When there are like nuclear weapons and when the aircraft carrier are invented, the face of the battle of the sea, the face of the armed conflict is totally changed. So with the emerging technologies, not just the internet and the social media, and also like the unmanned vehicles on the land and under the sea, and also like all kinds of different technologies being used in military affairs. Apparently, the face of armed conflict is like it's changing, and I'm telling you, it's only what we see today is only the tip of the iceberg. There are a lot of more to come. If we look at the concept of the revolution of warfare, and the beginning of the revolution of the warfare is it begins with the change of the equipment and how people fight the equipment, and then it goes to the structure of the military. And because of the military, the troops have to be reorganized according to the change of the ways how we fight. And then the change of structure goes to military doctrines and military theories. That's after that, that's the whole set of change of the warfare, or we said military affairs. So misinformation, disinformation, or what you call the cognitive warfare, is just a part of it. And I think, personally, we are now experiencing a new set of the revolution of warfare. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Yangqi. And I think that's even more of a complication in terms of that, you know, we're talking about not only war, but we're also talking about how it's being fought, yeah, and what are the new stressors coming in. We're going to be very soon in AI in terms of talking about that, mm-hmm. But I want to get back also to the international system, and I know, Aydin, you had wanted the word. Floor.
Just very briefly, I think two words summarize today's discussion. It's hypocrisy and double standards. When I look at the international systems, historically, different types of international systems, they seem to be more stable and long-term when they are based on shared, widely shared foundations and generally accepted norms. Norms doesn't have to be democratic, doesn't have to be humanitarian, doesn't have to be good, liberal, or whatever, but norms that are accepted widely by the society, international society, and by the states, enables the system to continue longer time in instability. When we look at, again, historically to the international systems, the periods of stability is decreasing in terms of years, and periods of transition between systems are increasing. which is usually the transition periods are marked by conflict and warfare. So it's our job to understand the current dynamics in order to shorten these periods of transition, which we are going through since 1991. So far as I can see, it has been already the longest transition period between two international systems. So we are in it. In order to able to find way out, I think what we need to do is to acknowledge the emergence of new structures and new power centers, first of all. The second, we have to strive to find minimally globally shared foundations and norms based on what I would call Gramscian understanding of consent, not coercion, consent. And finally, we have to emphasize openness, clarity, not defensive protectionism and violating the already existing few rules. Right? Here, we have to strive to find more engagement with more actors and inclusiveness, consultation, instead of what I see is kind of closed-door, backroom policymaking with few like-minded countries. You know, as the English say, the old boy club does not work. We have to find more inclusiveness to bring in other actors to hear their voices. Let me finish that.
That was an excellent appeal for a better world, I must say. And I agree with you, and I would also add something to that, and that is basically the admission that an unequal standard has prevailed for far too long. And I remember yesterday in the Ukraine discussion, it came up that member states who supported, obviously, the Ukraine position, they were surprised that they didn't get a full support of 193 member states or 192 or 190 member states in the General Assembly. They only got about 140. And basically what it put the spotlight on is that there is a double standard that's existed far too long and that's also been evidenced in this particular case. And I think the admission that, yes, there was a double standard, I think is a very important one. And you mentioned also the ICC, Happy Moon, in terms of, you know, using the international structures. And I think there's also a selectiveness about using it in terms of who is state party to it, or it's the ICG or whatever. So the tools clearly need to be looked at again, but also we can only do that once we have exactly the points that that Aydin mentioned in terms of an understanding, an agreement, finding a measure of consensus among the major member states, but also all member states, not only the select few. Let me turn over again. I know there was a question here, Martin, I think you had it. And then I'm sorry, I'm kind of turning my back on you all. I do apologize. And I will have here Irene, you will also be, and then we'll get some more. Yes, and we will have you. So let's take those three and maybe four, one more. And then we'll get the, sorry, we'll see what we can do. Yeah. So here, I think it was,
Thank you so much. I appreciate the high-level analysis of the panelists and the smart ways of handling each issue that has been presented. My name is Dr. Franklin from the Pan-African Institute for Development in Africa. I have one question which goes or links to the essence of human beings that we are and the values which we uphold. And my question is on how does this new dynamics in the global new world order guarantee civilian protection and humanitarian assistance in these dynamics or the disorder that these new dynamics bring into the world order? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Maybe we can bring the microphone over here.
Thank you very much. Thank you for excellent panel. Irene Gina, I'm with the board of the ACP here. Professor Mustafa Aydin, you started out by saying that the power relations-based multipolarity does no longer exist and is also not really able to address the global challenges that humanity faces. So if we take your analysis, And if we indeed we live in different worlds on this one globe, what's your recommendation to address some of the global challenges? For example, climate change, but also, you know, other issues that you mentioned. Thank you.
Why don't you hand the phone, or the microphone, to this gentleman? Since I was turning my back on you,
First of all, I would like to say thank you very much. It was really brilliant, and I enjoyed to listen to you. My name is Amir Somer. I'm an author and poet and student for conflict resolution in River Phoenix Center for Peace Building, Florida, USA. But most of all, I'm a son. I'm the child of the conflict, let's call it. I'm the son of a Palestinian Arab man, an Israeli Jewish woman. Therefore, it was really moving to listen to all of you. But I would like to share with you something. I noticed that we as peace builders tend to sometimes focus on the conflict rather than on the resolution. But I think that most of the people, at least in my place, in my nations, would like to gain some hope out of conflict resolution. There is a sentence of a jazz musician that I really like. This musician called Sanra, and he said, "Birds in a cage think flying is an illness." I think that at least we in the Middle East suffer from some sort of a plateau cave allegory. We tend to think that peace is an illness. And I would like to share with you my thought that maybe in the end of discussions like this, where we're focusing on hard topics, it will be also nice perhaps to end it with some sort of hope for some paradigm shift in the future. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. And we got over there. Excuse me, to the right, Mr. Kobler. He was one of the very first ones in the first round. I don't want to miss him.
Yeah. Thank you very much. My name is Martin Kobler. I'm a member of the board and ex-UN official and ex-German German diplomat. Thank you very much for all your contributions. And when looking at the countries you are coming from, I mean, we see three frozen conflicts, namely Cyprus, Kashmir, and Taiwan. My question relates, I would like to challenge a little bit the might and right theory. Yes, if you have might, then you do what you can do. However, this is not right. So my question relates to the parallel world emerging now on versus the normative world of the United Nations. Now, if we speak of rules-based global order, I mean, we have the UN Charter there. Now, there is a provision in the UN Charter, Article 109, that you can change it, of course, the revision of the UN Charter. So to bridge the gap between what is evolving now and the normative order of the UN Charter, would this be a possibility that your countries just open the Charter and try to reconcile the multipolar with the rules-based, emerging multipolar world with a rules-based order? Now, whenever I test this theory, everybody says this is Pandora's box, don't do it. But why not? Second question, very briefly, you mentioned the anxiety of the populations in the fragmented world. Indeed, we see this in Europe. I'm not an expert on the psyche of India and China. Is it also there the case? Are they anxious about what is developing in your countries as people are in Europe? Thank you.
What's developing in the sense?
Well, the Mustafa said, I think the fragmented world and the pandemic we have and the new developments of the multipolar world, this leads to anxieties in societies. We feel it, and polarization and the changing political order in our domestic policies, I see this in Europe. However, I would like to know whether it's the case in your population blocks. Thank you.
Okay, we have one more. We have one more. We have two more. Please be quick. Yeah, and then I'm closing the...
I'll be very short. So I'm from North Macedonia. I'm working in civil society sector, also doing peace building. And I have a question. So how much of the inner situation in your countries, the standards you implement within your country, gives you credibility to push for different for standards worldwide? I mean, for multilateral order. We speak now.
Thank you. And right behind you.
Thank you. My name is Naomi Binta Stansley. I'm from Niger. Niger is West Africa in the Sahel. I thank all the panelists, and I think that there should be an African panelist in this panel, because all of this positioning power is taking place in Africa, actually in the Sahel. All these Russians, Chinese, and Turkish, in European, everybody's coming to Africa to get that power. I think this power is from Africa too. And they want to hear you about that. Thank you.
Very, very thoughtful, very inquisitive questions ranging from the human person, Africa, more larger, let's say, concerns about what can you recommend. So we are just about out of time, but I give the panelists, obviously, a few minutes. I hope you don't mind shortening our coffee break just a tiny little bit to let them respond. So, Aydin, can I start with you?
Yeah, there is a popular saying in Turkey that I'm not the only soldier of the nation. So I think we cannot solve all the world problems. And by training, I'm told that I'm a gloomy person, always looking from a pessimist perspective, and good at diagnostics, but not treatment. So I don't know exact results and exact recommendations, except the ones that I already mentioned. But what I know is the contemporary world is moving with the technological changes, artificial intelligence, which we really don't know yet exactly what it will be moving, and with speed. With speed. We are not accustomed to think in this kind of speed environment. Maybe artificial intelligence might help us to understand this speed, the speed of conflict, the speed of politics, the speed of policy making, and etc. So we have to, at least me personally, who are a children of the old world, I'm educated in the old world system, and I don't see myself qualified to find the solutions to the new world problems. I think the younger generation is the new soldier to find solutions to these problems, not us, the older generations. And I'd like to also respond to this, whether it's possible to kind of reform the old system, the United Nations system. I'm quite known in Turkey to defending the United Nations system against the president of Turkey, who is arguing rightly from his perspective that the world is greater than five. He repeats this everywhere in order to push for UN reform. And I keep arguing in Turkey that UN is an instrument. It's just a reflection of the balances in the world. It's a reflection of the system we can create it at 50, 70 years ago. But again, looking into the history and reading the history, humanity have not been able to create a common, a joint international structure like UN or League of Nations before, or VN, European Concert before, and everything. We have not been able to create this kind of systems without a global war, without a big war. Whether we are more wise today, one needs to hope that we are more wiser today, but I have very much doubt looking into the post-truth society, looking through the misinformation and disinformation, everything. I don't think we are more wiser than our predecessors. So I have a gloomy view that we will not be able to reform the system as it exists today. And I'll finish with the example from a book, which is a book about domestic politics. It's nothing to do with international relations. I have to remember. Ian Bremmer wrote a book called J Curve, talking about the reform in authoritarian systems and whether etc. And he was saying that when you try to reform an authoritarian system, there is a point where reform goes too much beyond the necessary, then the system collapses and it starts taking everybody under. And it's again very gloomy perspective because we all push for reform in authoritarian systems and etc. If we apply this to international system, the attempts to reform from a certain beyond a certain point, the existing systems might just undermine them and take us all under this reform process. So we might just try to live with the system, but try to find parallel structures. Maybe create new structures that might prop up the old system instead of trying to reform the old system. I don't have a better answer to this yet.
Thank you. That was excellent. Thank you. Let me reverse the order a little bit. Maybe I'll take Jiangqi and then we'll come to you, Happy Moon.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, actually, I quite agree with Mustafa. It's like we cannot solve the problem in one day, and we cannot solve problems through meetings. But at least it's a good start. Actually, from my institution, we are the organizer of the Xiangshan Forum. Sometimes Xiangshan Forum is like one of the biggest military diplomacy event in China. So sometimes my colleagues and I, we discuss like what is the meaning or what is the value of this kind of like multilateral meetings, and does it really matter if like we spend so much of money to gather people around the world to come here and to have a meeting of 3 or 4 days? Actually, we think it matters. That actually is the value. Like the Rome is not built in one day, so every day we can clear out some of the misunderstandings. Every day through every meeting, we clear out some of the misperceptions, and then we know each other better than yesterday. That is the meaning of the meeting. That's how we make peace. In our institutions, we have a saying like, we analyze the war to avoid it. We study the void, so we do not need to actually fight it. I think that's that's the meaning of why we discuss conflict, why we discuss the wars today here, to actually avoid it in the future. And referring to the question that the gentleman brought it here, I think in China we have a saying like, you ask whether we are anxious about the developing of the world today. In China we have a saying like, the history and the change of time and history is unfolded in an unprecedented way. So we can say it's either negative or it's more positive. We don't know what's going to lead us. We just embrace the future with open arms and open minds. We hope together we can make the world a better place. That's my statement.
That's a very hopeful statement, Jiangqi. Thank you for that. But now we have Happy Moon.
Thank you. I think, let me start with the question about anxiety. Are the people in countries like ours anxious about what's happening in the world? No, sir. That's a first world problem. In our part of the world, we are concerned more about the next meal. We are concerned more about the local problems. I mean, I don't mean to sort of discredit the argument. I'm simply saying, no, that is not really on top of the... On the one hand. On the other hand, if you look at the Indian society and its economy, we've never had it this good. We look at the world and say, we're doing pretty well. So we therefore have no complaints about how the world is going. It has to be better, of course. The ruling elite thinks it has to be better. The intellectuals think it has to be better. For the common people, no. We've never had it this good. So perfect. No problem. The question about UN reforms. Absolutely, yes. I think there is an abiding belief in countries like India that UN must be reformed. What is the UN Security Council? It is a family picture of the victors of the Second World War plus China. That needs to be framed and kept away, and we need to have a new picture wherein more emerging powers are part of that. I think this conversation about taking a relook at the UN Charter, the specific, I think that conversation needs to begin. Unfortunately, that conversation hasn't taken place in countries like India. I think that's a great point to take back. My third point is about, yes, we countries like ours also have our own skeletons. Kashmir, you rightly pointed out, that is a skeleton. China has, other countries have their own issues to deal with. But, you know, and by this I don't mean to dismiss the importance of those conflicts. What I'm trying to say is that when smaller powers have issues, they matter less to the rest of the international community. When great powers or superpowers practice hypocrisy or they have issues with other countries, it has global implications. Not that what we do don't have implications for our population, it does. But when big powers behave in irresponsible ways, it has global implications. What we do probably doesn't have global implications. Final question, several of you talked about the importance of, so what do we do now? I think there are several ways, but I agree with the two colleagues that the first step in searching for a solution must begin with acknowledging the problem as it is. And I think we have done a good job of, half good job of doing that. But I think, as I said in the beginning, a country like India believes in orderly transition. We don't want to be revolutionary. We don't want to be revisionist. We think a better international order must be there, and that has to be gradually approached and not in a revolutionary sense. So that we can't undo what we already have. We need to make the current structure more equitable and egalitarian. We should also empower regional institutions and regional organizations like ASEAN is a great example. So invest in those institutions for undertaking conflict resolution, be it African Union or structures of that kind. We can't have initiatives or structures that are unmindful of regional realities. That's why R2P will not work. Responsibility to protect will not work precisely because we don't think this accommodates the concerns of the regional powers. I think we must be very careful in letting and setting up global institutions dominated by one value system. That is why end of history and the last man is problematic, not because there is a fundamental problem with democracy, but because countries are differently located, countries are differently placed. The hegemonic universality is not the answer. Not that atomistic particularity is an answer. But you know, let me end by saying, with all these philosophical notions going back and forth, I think one of the main reasons we are assembled here, let's be very clear, is the Russia-Ukraine war. And we understand the plight that the Ukrainians are going through. But as several of you have pointed out, we have problems in our part of the world too. But therefore, please don't make us part of your wars. We have our wars to fight. This is a war that's happening here. Don't make it global. Don't make it universal. This is not a universal war. Don't enlist us in your wars without our consent, without our permission. And sanctions and secondary sanctions are a very indirect, clever way of enlisting us in your wars without our permission. I think that needs to stop. Thank you. Back to you.
Thank you very much. Before you start applauding, let me just make one comment, and that is that we have spoken mostly about the global level, but several of you have raised also the personal level, the human being that's at the heart of all of the concerns. And I want to acknowledge that. We did not really have time to go into this, but obviously every family, every person wants to live in peace, not in a fragmented world, wants to educate their children, wants to have a good life. You mentioned humanitarian assistance, and again, you know, coming from the United Nations also, I know how much is done on that level, and it's never enough. So I want to acknowledge that. But I think we had really a very, very good discussion, and I thank all of the panelists for being so forceful and so outspoken and giving us their opinion. We haven't really come to a lot of recommendations, except I think that you mentioned some of the aspects. I hope they will be heard by powers other than ourselves, and I think we should give them a big hand of applause. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Angela. Thank you so much to all of our speakers for this truly insightful panel. Please make your way to your workshop rooms now. Coffee will be served there. Lunch, as I've said, is in the courtyard. The workshops will continue in the afternoon in the same rooms that they started in. And we'll see you back here at 5 for a panel that will focus more on resolution than conflict. Enjoy your day.